CEM Network is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart and Born to Win. I love a good mystery, and puzzle solving is a favorite pastime of mine. So perhaps I can be forgiven for saying, as I did in a recent program, that God also loves a mystery. Sometimes, of course, he speaks plainly, and the Ten Commandments are plain enough. But other times, the truth is far more subtle. I might offer reasons for God's subtlety, and they're there, but I hardly need to prove that. Anyone who pays attention to God's actions in the world will be well aware that God prefers to be subtle, even when you're confident that something that's happened has been his intervention. But the Bible is a little more than mere subtlety. It's a collection of the testimony of witnesses. And while I certainly believe in the inspiration of the Bible, I also believe that God doesn't engage in witness tampering. The Holy Spirit sees to it that the witnesses are in court and that they tell the truth. After that, we, the jury, have to evaluate their testimony and try to figure out the larger picture. Now, if you've ever watched a bunch of Perry Mason mysteries or this type of thing, the courtroom dramas, you can often find your way to the truth of what happened, and we know this, even though no individual witness knows the whole story. You get a little bit from this fellow, you get a little bit from that fellow, you get something from a third lady, and between those three things, the picture comes together. Well, now, something like that exists in the Bible. There's enough corroboration of the gospel accounts to support the key elements of their stories. They all saw the resurrected Christ, for example, and they're all unified. Yeah, there may be little details, but those aren't important. The differences that you find in the accounts show us that the witnesses were not in collusion. In other words, this is important to establish the fact that there were four witnesses, not four witnesses telling one witness's story, if you follow me. There are some first-class mysteries in the New Testament. Many of them have kept scholars scratching their heads for years and have provided material for countless doctoral dissertations. Consider as a case in point the mystery of how you get 3 days and three nights between Friday night and Sunday morning. You know, Friday night, that's one night. Saturday, that's a day. Saturday night, that's one night. So you got two nights in one day. And you probably know what I'm driving at, even if you're not a Christian. You've heard all this because of the holidays we have. Christian tradition has Jesus crucified on Good Friday and raised from the dead on Sunday morning, having been buried just at the end of Good Friday. And nearly everyone knows that Jesus said, just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so Jesus would be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. There's some marvelously creative theories to account for all this. Some just prefer to declare, well, it's just a Greek idiom, and it's fulfilled in any part of three separate days are involved. Well, I've dug out all the relevant texts, and I can't make that work. It might work on a stretch if Jesus had merely said 3 days, but he didn't. He used an emphatic 3 days and three nights. The thing is, there is some non-grammatical evidence that needs to be considered and usually has not been. You know, you can talk about Greek idioms all you want, but let's put the language on the shelf and let's come back to the real world. Let me start with a point of clarification. Everyone knows that the day following Jesus' crucifixion was a Sabbath day, right? What everyone doesn't seem to know is that the Jewish holy days, the Jewish holidays, all except one, were Sabbath days. Note, I didn't say they fell on a Sabbath. I said they are Sabbath days. And that is so, even if the calendar date for one of them falls on a Thursday. In that case, Thursday is a Sabbath, and the day before it is a preparation day. Now, let me advance a theory for your consideration. Suppose that Jesus was not crucified on a Friday, but on a Wednesday. He was then put in the tomb in haste, just as the sun was going down. Jewish days begin at sunset. Now let's count out 3 days and three nights. You've got Wednesday night, Thursday, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday. And there we are. 3 days and three nights. It works. But is that what happened? Well, let me put some witnesses on the stand and let's consider their testimony and see what one of them might know that the other did not. Behold, there was a man named Joseph, who was a member of the Jewish council, a good man, a righteous man, who had not consented to their plan and to their action. He was a man from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, waiting for the kingdom of God. Now, this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. He took it down off the cross, wrapped it in a linen cloth, and laid him into a tomb cut into the rock where no one had ever lain. And it was the preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. You'll find that in Luke 23, and it begins about verse 50. Now, there wasn't much of the day left when Jesus was laid in that tomb and the stone rolled across the entrance. And we have firmly established that the day following the crucifixion was a Sabbath day. But which kind of Sabbath day was it? Was it the weekly Sabbath? Or was it one of the annual Sabbath days that fell on a calendar date, a holiday? Well, we'll back up just a little bit in time and consider the testimony of John. Call John to the stand. Here's what he had to say. After this, knowing that all things had already been accomplished in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I'm thirsty." He is still on the cross. A jar full of sour wine was standing there, and they put a sponge full of it on a branch and brought it up to his mouth. And when he had received the sour wine, he said, "It's finished." And he bowed his head and gave up the spirit. The Jews, therefore, because it was the day of preparation, so the bodies would not remain on the cross for the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and they might be taken away. So the Sabbath of the next day was a high day. It was the first day of the Feast of Passover, and it need not have been on a Saturday. It could have been on a Thursday. It could have been on a Tuesday. It moved through the week. Now, here's our problem. How can we tell whether it was a weekly Sabbath or not? Continuing in John's account. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, a disciple of Jesus, another interesting point, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. So he took away his body. Nicodemus, another familiar name from the New Testament, also came with him. He had came to Jesus some time ago by night. They brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds worth. And they took the body of Jesus, bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. I mean, right there next to it. In the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. In fact, it belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. Therefore, on account of the Jewish day of preparation, and because the tomb was closed, they laid Jesus there. The clear implication is that if they had had more time before sunset, they might well have taken Jesus to another location. But they felt it was important to get Jesus in the ground quickly. That is in complete accord with Jewish burial customs. They don't like to delay burial at all. Preferably, a person should be put in the grave the same day he dies. What's important about this is that the burial had to be done hastily in order to be complete before the sun went down, beginning the Sabbath. There is no day left of the preparation day to count. Now, Luke, from a slightly different perspective, notes, "The women also that came with him from Galilee followed afterward and beheld the sepulchre and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment." Did you catch that problem? They had to rush to get this body buried. They buried him right next to the place of crucifixion because they had no time to go anywhere else. How could these women have watched the burial and the completion of the burial and had time to go home and prepare spices before the Sabbath day came? There isn't any way. If you think that's difficult, I'll call in another witness who saw something else that happened. But first, grab a pencil and paper because I want to give you an address and a phone number. You'll want to take them down for some special offers that we will have for you.
Why has the modern Christian church drifted away from the Sabbath day when the entire church observed the Sabbath throughout the New Testament period? For a free booklet titled Basic Christianity, The New Testament Sabbath, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791, or call toll free 1-888-BIBLE-44. That's 1-888-242-5344.
So here's the picture. They had to bury Jesus almost in the same place, just in a little garden right there below the place he was crucified. Why? Well, because they had no time to carry the body to another place. They had to get the body in the ground before the Sabbath day began. But we are told these women stood there, watched how the body was laid, watched this all take place. Then they returned and prepared spices and ointments, and then rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment. That just doesn't look like it would work, but it becomes a little clearer. Yeah, wait a minute, you have to wait for this. Mark's testimony is a little different. Mark 16, verse 1. It's not a major point, almost a throwaway line. He says, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so they might go and anoint Jesus' body. Whoops. They didn't buy their spices till after the Sabbath, but we've just been told they prepared their spices before the Sabbath. What happened? How can we understand this? Here's what took place. They bought their spices when the Sabbath was over, prepared their ointments and spices, and then rested on the Sabbath day. It's really easy to miss since the details of the sequence of events are spread over four Gospels. But the women saw Jesus buried in the last minutes before sundown, beginning the Sabbath. Then when the Sabbath was over, they bought spices, prepared them, and rested the second Sabbath day according to the commandment. This second Sabbath day was indeed Saturday. But when I said this second Sabbath, I drew an inference from the facts and the testimony before us. The inference is that there were two Sabbaths that week with a day in between. So my theory of a Wednesday crucifixion is not entirely out of court. But there's another important question here that bears on this. Why 3 days and three nights anyhow? What's the big deal about that? Why not just Jesus is dead? They bury him, they put him in the tomb, they roll the stone across it, and when they turn around, there stands Jesus saying, aha, fooled you, didn't I? In other words, why not an hour in the tomb? Why not overnight? Why 3 days and three nights? It turns out there really is a reason for that. If we ask this question, how they got into the picture, we can start by looking at another distinct example of a resurrection in the New Testament. There was a family in Bethany that was very special to Jesus. He loved Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, and no doubt he had spent a lot of time with them. So when they sent word to Jesus that Lazarus was sick and dying, they plainly expected him to come to them right away and heal him. But when the word came to Jesus, he delayed for two more days, which is really kind of odd considering the closeness of that family. He told his disciples, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God that the Son of Man might be glorified thereby. You'll find this story in the 11th chapter of John's Gospel. Now, after delaying these extra days, waiting deliberately for Lazarus to die, Jesus said to his disciples, Our friend Lazarus is sleeping, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Disciples didn't catch his drift at first, so Jesus spoke more plainly. Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there to the intent that you may believe. Nevertheless, let's go to him. Now, this is really an important section here because Jesus tells his disciples, I waited until he was dead because it was important that you would understand and believe what's going on here. Now, it's clear enough that Jesus intended to raise Lazarus from the dead right from the beginning. But this was terribly hard on Mary and Martha. When Martha heard Jesus was coming, she left the house to meet him. Mary stayed behind. Then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, whatever you will ask of God, God will give it to you. The pain of this moment is palpable. And that last phrase of Martha's seems to imply that she thought Jesus might indeed raise Lazarus from the dead. And Jesus replied, your brother will rise again. It's the answer we hear at the funeral after funeral of people we love. Your loved one will rise again. You will be reunited in the day of the resurrection. I know, said Martha, that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. And apparently she's implying that's not what I'm really asking for here. And Jesus' answer to this plaintive cry is the hope that all of us carry. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Martha did believe. And she returned to the house and quietly told Mary that Jesus had come at last. Mary got up quickly and went to Jesus. And when she found him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died. That had to hurt, even though Jesus knew what he was going to do. Knowing what Mary and Martha had to suffer, the passage in John tells us that he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. Here was Mary crying like her heart would break. A collection of mourners also had followed her for the house. And Jesus said, where have you laid him? Lord, come and see, they said. Jesus wept. The shortest verse in the Bible speaks volumes about Jesus' humanity. Even though he knew he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead, he hurt inside for the pain others were feeling. And there is something inside all of us that no matter how well prepared we think we are for the death of a loved one, weeping follows in the face of death. Still groaning, Jesus approached the cave where they had placed Lazarus. There was a stone across the entrance. He says, take it away. Martha protested, but Lord, by this time there's a bad odor. He's been there for 4 days. And this begins to answer the question of Jesus' delay. It had to be established that Lazarus was truly dead before Jesus raised him. Otherwise, somebody would have been saying, oh, well, he wasn't really dead. He just had swooned. He just was in a coma, and he recovered. No, he was dead to the point that his body would have begun to decay. Jesus called out, Lazarus, come forth! And the man who had been dead staggered out of the tomb, still wrapped in his shroud. We tend to forget in this day and age when we can be more certain through science when a person is dead, although even now we're still sometimes not sure. In ages gone by, they didn't even have that. Some held to a belief that the soul stayed with the body for 3 days after death. Here's what one Jewish source says. It's the Tractate Semahot, which means mourning. It says, one may go out to the cemetery for 3 days to inspect the dead for a sign of life, without fear that this smacks of heathen practice. For it happened that a man was inspected after 3 days and he went on to live 25 years. Still another went on to have 5 children and died later. Now, this is when you look at this, you say, wait a minute. What it's saying to us is that people who often appear to be dead aren't. And so it was that they waited and did not finalize the person's death for 3 days. Other Jewish sources believe that they should only use wood coffins, and they do not embalm the dead. The reason offered is that as the body decays, the soul ascends to heaven. And I presume that's one of the reasons the Jews do not approve of cremation either. The decay was assumed to begin after 3 days. So if Jesus had been buried at sunset on Friday and rose while it was still dark Sunday morning, he would have been in the tomb less than 36 hours. The Jews could have argued that he had not been dead. This is no miracle. He had merely lapsed into a coma and then recovered. So 3 days and three nights really is important. It's important to establish real death. 36 hours doesn't do it. But I realize in saying all this, I have raised still another problem. I'll talk about that right after this important message.
For a free cassette tape of this radio program that you can share with friends and others, write or call this week only and request the program titled 3 Days and Three Nights. Write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44 and tell us the call letters of this radio station.
Now, here is the next problem. If my theory is correct that Jesus was buried at sunset Wednesday, and if he was in the tomb 3 days and three nights, then Jesus rose from the dead, not Sunday morning, but Saturday about sunset. The problem is with something Mark said. It's in Mark 16 and verse 9, where it says, "Now when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast 7 devils. Sounds like he rose early the first day of the week. The question is whether the phrase "early the first day of the week" refers to the time of the resurrection or the time of his appearance. Now, Greek had no punctuation, but if you move the comma, this is what you get. Now, when Jesus was risen, comma, early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he cast 7 devils. There's another important fragment of testimony here. He appeared first to Mary Magdalene. What this tells us is that no one witnessed the time of the resurrection, only the time of Jesus' first appearance. So, my theory of the case seems to hold together through this small difficulty. And the Friday to Sunday period seems unlikely from the evidence. Now, there's a question someone's going to come up with. What was Jesus doing all night Saturday night? Well, there's no witness in the Bible to answer that question. But there was at this season a little notice ceremony in the temple service that was also about Christ. This was the season of the first ripe barley, but the people were not allowed to eat any of that year's crop until a small portion of it had been offered by God to the priest. It's called the wave sheaf in the King James Version, and the ceremony is described in Leviticus 23. This could not be done on the Sabbath. It was an act of work. They had to harvest the grain, they had to prepare it, and they did it during the night. This work was done when the Sabbath ended. It's described in Alfred Edersheim's well-known book on the rites and services of the temple in the time of Christ. The ceremony took place right after the Sabbath day, according to the law. It was an act of work to harvest the wave sheaf. So just after sunset, a little group of people wound their way down to a field that had been prepared ahead of time. And they found one of the sheaves that was there. A man stood over it, holding a sickle in his hand. He shouts a series of questions to the crowd gathered round him. Now, mind you, this is just after sunset. They shouted their answers back at him. He said, "Is the sun down?" The crowd answered, "Yes." "This sheaf?" "Yes." "With this sickle?" "Yes." "Shall I reap?" "Yes." And with a stroke, he cut the sheaf of the first fruits from the ground. And that may have been the moment when Jesus, who is also called the first fruits in the Bible, opened his eyes in the tomb. Through that night, the sheaf was prepared for offering. The grain was threshed from it, parched in a pan over fire, and early the next morning, it was presented to God in the temple. This sheaf is the very first of the first fruits from the fields around Jerusalem. And this seems to be the imagery that Paul is driving at in that beautiful resurrection chapter of 1 Corinthians 15. He says, "Now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept. For since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead. As in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Every man in his own order. Christ the first fruits, afterward they that are Christ's at his coming." Paul understood all this, and it's a clear allusion to the harvest of that first fruit of the barley from the ground as a symbol of Jesus being the first of many that would be resurrected ultimately to stand before God. For some reason, this image of the harvest is repeated again and again in Jesus' ministry to try to impress upon their people's minds that what we are doing is harvesting people from this life for God's kingdom. When Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene the first time after his resurrection, she grabbed him by the feet and he says, "Don't hold me back. I have not yet ascended to my Father. You go tell my brethren, saying, I ascend to my Father and your Father and to my God and to your God." Later that same day, Jesus would allow his disciples to touch him and to hold him. And the plain implication is that between the time Mary saw him and the time he met with his disciples, he had ascended to the Father and returned, and no doubt was presented before the Father at the same time the wave sheaf was being waved in the temple. The first fruits of the dead was Jesus. Funny thing about this verse, it's consistently called the first day of the week in all translations, but in the Greek, it is the first day of the weeks. It's day one of the 7 weeks that count down to the Feast of Pentecost, which is indeed the Feast of the First Fruits. Until next time, I'm Ronald Dart.
You have heard Ronald L. Dart. If you would like more information, or if you have any questions, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. In the U.S. and Canada, call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. And visit our website at borntowin.net.